Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I've had a lot going on this week and have not been able to get out to do a local interview. I understand there was a protest outside of the Columbus Police Headquarters the other night that during that protest, a lone individual actually entered the police headquarters. The building itself, that is, and was met with some violence. The unannounced protest was apparently in response to both the news of yet another police killing of an unarmed black man in Minnesota, Dante White, who police body cam footage shows was initially cooperating with several officers who pulled him over for having expired temporary tags on his newly acquired vehicle, something that wouldn't even be a violation in Ohio right now, and for having some air fresheners dangling from his rearview mirror. The police approached Dante aggressively, and at some point, Dante reacted in fright and slipped out of the officer's grip and returned to the seat of his car. At that point, officers began shouting at him, and a senior female officer, who was on the call as a trainer, pulled out her gun and shouted, "I'll tase you, taser, taser, taser," and then fired a single shot that killed Dante. The officer claimed she mistook her gun for the taser. Even though the two weapons are always kept on opposite hips, one is a heavy metal black gun and the other is a light plastic orange thing. And she held the weapon in front of her precisely in the way that officers are trained to hold their guns. All of this is quite unmistakable on the body cam footage. I think most people would agree that the killing of Dante White was uncalled for, unjustified, and a crime for which the shooter must be held accountable. Some, however, are saying that it was Dante's fault that he escalated the situation by attempting to flee. They point to his short rap sheet and note that he was charged with unlawfully possessing a gun at one point, and that he had a warrant out for him after he failed to make a court date. But the more rational and compassionate, or should I say less bigoted minds, understand that Dante is not on trial here, even though his killer soon will be. And even if one were to ascribe a portion of blame to Wright, the fact remains that he was pulled over for the most insignificant type of violation, and moments later he was dead at the hands of the police. And all of this happened just a few miles from the trial of another former police officer, Derek Chauvin, who smothered George Floyd to death with his knee during an arrest for a similarly insignificant crime, for which Floyd was merely a suspect. Some are saying that if either Floyd or Wright had only cooperated and complied with the officer's commands, they'd still be alive, even as Chauvin's defense attorney tries to convince a jury that Floyd, who had a few health challenges, including a drug addiction, was on death's door even before the encounter with Chauvin. But we know that compliance isn't a guarantee of safety. That knowledge has many names, including Elijah McCain, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, John Crawford, Tamir Rice, and here in Columbus, Casey Goodson and Andre Hill. It's possible that we'll see a verdict in the Chauvin trial by next week, and we'll either be watching the news closely as we turn our focus to other cases, past and present, or we'll be in the streets demanding substantial reforms to prevent these murders in the future. And of course, we'll do our best to try to follow it here on Conscious Voices, the only radio program in Columbus that has consistently brought you full audio and a nuanced discussion of these protests and their causes. This week, however, it is also coming up on Earth Day, and so we'll join some producers from one of our Pacific affiliates, KBOO, or KBOO, in Oregon, Portland, Oregon, and a bi-weekly show that they create called Let's Talk About Race. This edition takes a look at some of the many facets of environmental racism.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race, with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race. This is our Earth Day episode.
Our topic today, things fall apart. Our crumbling infrastructure places all of us, especially people of color and low-income people, at risk for emergencies such as utility blackouts and water shortages. We have major extreme weather events now in the United States. And the antecedent for this is climate change and environmental racism. Things fall apart on this edition of Let's Talk About Race. So Cecil, the topic is things fall apart, poor infrastructure and climate change. How does this impact people of color? And you wanted to talk about the history of environmental racism.
I think it's important to recognize that people of color, particularly here in the United States, how the notion of the environment has impacted us in many ways for many generations. In the 1980s, we saw a galvanization of the environmental justice movement as mostly poor Black communities were the places where hazardous waste landfills were established. This happened in many communities in the South, particularly in places such as North Carolina. The study of the toxic waste movement caught the eyes of United Church of Christ Commission on Racial Justice in the 1980s, which examined the statistical relationship between the location of hazardous waste sites and the racial, social, economic compositions of communities. And what we discovered in 1987 was a very important study that was released by the Commission on Racial Justice, which addressed the issues of race, class, and environment on national level. After that, we saw the gathering of people in many communities, Black and brown communities, addressing the hazards and the many environmental dangers they faced and how it impacted not only their employment, but health. And so we saw what became known as the environmental justice movement and the examination of the environment of a phenomenon that was known as environmental racism. Fast forward 30 years, and we see that the climate justice movement incorporates the needs and the concerns of racial communities, not only in the United States, but also throughout the world. And we see throughout the world the impact of climate change on poor communities throughout the world.
Well, Cecil, you and I live in the Pacific Northwest. Althea also lives in the Pacific Northwest. I have seen county and city governments use recycling and bike lanes as a way to gentrify communities of color, especially in Portland, Oregon.
I think the notion, the common idea that the traditional environmental movement has centered in the concerns of middle-class people. And so what we have witnessed is the concerns of recycling, reducing, which focus on the needs and the concerns of middle-class white people. I had a friend a few years ago who said that if you want to know where gentrification is coming, look to see where they are placing the bike lanes. And that is certainly here in where I live in the city of Portland, Oregon. We saw that, how a historic drive to move Black and brown communities continue in the environmental movements and here in Portland in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s and continuing today. So the gentrification movement saw the dismantling of Black communities here in the Pacific Northwest. And what we see now, I think, is a pushback to challenge not only the traditional ways in which we think of the environment, but trying to see how Black and Brown communities are impacted by the policies of not only gentrifiers, but also the policies of corporations, and how, for example, Black and Brown communities suffer most from the environmental hazards in terms of health disparities. And so we see a reckoning of those who have been traditionally part of the environmental movement and the influx of people asking for them to look at things through a racial justice lens. And this can only help our communities and certainly help the movement to create a world in which all people and indeed all creations are preserved and able to prosper.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race. This is our Earth Day episode.
Temperatures this morning are in the single digits in the Texas Panhandle, around zero this morning in Dallas, near 20 in Houston, and even down towards Brownsville, it's 20 to 25.
Right.
Yesterday, the entire state of Texas was under a winter storm warning. In 30 years of doing this, I have never seen that in my career.
In February, millions of Texans were without power and water for days, and dozens lost their lives as a result, including an 11-year-old boy. The power outages were triggered by extreme cold that increased demand for heating. Couple that with the state's largest source of electricity, natural gas, falling short, with frozen wellheads, icy condensation blocking pipelines, and compressor stations shutting down. Texas Tribune reports, quote, Texas regulators and lawmakers knew about the grid's vulnerabilities for years, but time and again they furthered the interests of large electricity providers. They report that power players repeatedly ignored, dismissed, or watered down efforts to address weaknesses in the state's sprawling electrical grid, which is isolated from the rest of the country. Texas is the only state in the contiguous U.S. that operates its own electric grid. That makes it difficult for other regions to send excess power in times of crisis, especially when they are facing their own shortages. All other states in the lower 48, as well as peripheral areas of Texas, are connected to one of two grids that span the eastern and western halves of the country. The state also isn't subject to federal oversight by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission because Texas operates its own grid. Many energy experts say the very nature of the state's deregulated electric market is perhaps most to blame for February's power crisis. In Texas, a handful of mega utilities controlled the distribution and pricing of the power they produced until two decades ago, when the state legislature shifted to a system where companies would compete for customers on the open market. Lawmakers said the change would result in lower power bills and better service, but that's a promise that some experts and advocates say has not been kept. Under this system, power companies aren't required to produce enough electricity to get the state through crises like the one in February. In fact, they're incentivized to ramp up generation only when dwindling power supplies have driven up prices.
You're currently living in the state of Texas, which is experiencing quite a bit. You were out without power for a number of days, but for low-income people of color, really suffered in Texas through their unique system of keeping taxes low, keeping prices low until something happens. And because of climate change, something happened. Do you want to expand on that?
First, I just want to add a little bit of information that taxes are not really low in Texas. Texas does have a sales tax that's around 8%, and that's pretty much on everything you purchase. Oftentimes, the state is represented as being perhaps cheaper to live in, but there are other factors like property taxes here. We're in the top 10 counties in the United States for property taxes. People here aren't doing necessarily as well as one would think, although there are very wealthy people, obviously a lot of money in Texas. Texas got a black eye this past week. We're supposed to be the energy capital of the nation. And yet we had 4.5 million people that were out of power. some of the residuals of being out of power don't get contemplated in what that means. And that was the impact on the water supply. Not only were you out of power, you also did not have water. The water plants couldn't necessarily run their equipment. So there was very low water pressure, no water pressure, frozen pipes, broken pipes. All of these things contributed to people suffering during those 8 days of Arctic Storm Uri.
As many Texans enter their second or third day without power, with no definitive end in sight, some are questioning how such a widespread meltdown is even possible. The answer lies with Texas's energy grid.
So Texas opted long ago to be the only state that maintains its own independent grid from the rest of the country and Canada. This is to avoid federal regulations. But federal regulations also force most electric producers in this country to be further winterized for situations like this.
That means power plants in Texas haven't necessarily taken the steps that others in, say, Minnesota or Maine or even Arizona take to ensure they can keep operating in frigid temperatures. And while other states with interconnected grids can essentially borrow power from each other when demand spikes, Texas's go-it-alone approach left it without anywhere to borrow from. Now, this unusually large storm is exposing the vulnerabilities of that underregulated system as it struggles to cope with wind and ice. Around half the state's power comes from liquid natural gas.
So some of the natural gas producers in the state have had serious interruptions because of the storm, especially in the Permian Basin and Panhandle. Freezing conditions have slowed production. Wind has caused disruptions. Some have closed because of concerns for employee safety.
At the same time, wind turbines across the state are freezing for lack of winterization. And some solar panels are rendered useless by overcast conditions. All of these flaws combining to create major shortages.
But the focus of some on renewables like wind and solar.
Joe Biden and Democrats better think twice about unleashing the Green New Deal on the whole country. Just take a look at what's happening in Texas.
Doesn't tell nearly the whole story.
Only about a quarter of the electricity in Texas comes from wind and solar. And of all the power that went offline, about a third of it was from failures in the wind supply. That's according to ERCOT. They're responsible for managing Texas's energy grid.
ERCOT is the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. It's basically the air traffic controller for power in the state.
They manage about 90% of the state's energy, but they've had to order rolling outages to conserve the limited power for essentials like hospitals. We talked to ERCOT's CEO about why that's necessary.
We saw a challenge in managing supply and demand, and we thought we might have to use rotating outages to manage that. And so we call on the utilities in different parts of Texas to, we'll say, we need the demand reduced by, for example, 1,000 megawatts. And they will turn off circuits, turn off power for the period of time that we need to maintain that safe power balance.
The impact on Texans has been devastating. In addition to the deaths, people across the state are experiencing freezing in their own home, food shortages, and long lines at grocery stores, and burst pipes causing flooding.
Experts warn that weather events like these could happen more often in a world stricken by climate change.
We can treat this almost as an opportunity here, that we are planning on making very large changes to our power system. The Biden administration has an aggressive plan for decarbonizing our power system. We know that if we want to achieve a just and equitable world without climate change, or with very low climate change, we need to make drastic changes. And so these changes are going to be happening at the same time as we are experiencing climate change.
I think that Texas is a great example of what happens when politics make decisions around these issues. Texas was not able to use energy from any other states because Texas is the only standalone state with their own electrical grid. They cannot share power and they cannot borrow power from other states that participate in the national grid. That was one problem. The other problem, and I think there's been a lot on the news about the Electric Reliability Council or ERCOT, there's finger pointing with our governor, Greg Abbott, and an investigation being launched into ERCOT. No one's talking about the fact that the board members on ERCOT are actually picked by the governor, and yet he has these issues with ERCOT. There's clearly oversight that didn't happen, a unwillingness to weatherize, even though there have been major freezes in Texas, and they were well aware of this vulnerability as far back as 1999. The current mayor of Houston actually had submitted a bill to weatherize and to also require ERCOT to store extra power so that we would never have an outage. That bill was shut down. No bills to improve this grid or to weatherize this grid have passed. There's this notion of we want small government, we want no oversight, and this is what happens. And then the most vulnerable communities suffer. We were under a boil water order. Everyone had to boil their water. If you have no electricity, how are you going to boil water? So we saw long lines at gas stations, no food in the grocery stores because the supply chain was disrupted. We had our Commissioner of Agriculture who said that we will continue to experience disruptions in the supply chain. They dumped hundreds of thousands of gallons of milk because of this electrical failure. They couldn't process it. They had hundreds of thousands of little chicks that died, froze to death. Crops have been frozen. We will continue to see that. And once again, then people will suffer because it will raise the cost of produce and other grocery items. That's the only way that the farmers are going to be able to make it. And they just dug their way out of COVID. Shut down. So again, those are things that could have been avoided. They were well known in advance. There was inaction because of this thinking that we don't want government, we don't want oversight. As a result, you know, thousands of people are suffering right now. Food pantries, they can't keep up with the demand. Most of the demand appears to be Black and brown people that are going to the food pantries for food.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race. This is our Earth Day episode. Texas's winter storm could make life worse for Black and Latino families hit hard by power outages. That's a headline from USA Today. They spoke with Chauncia Willis, the chief executive of the Institute for Diversity and Inclusion in Emergency Management. Willis said, quote, "What you will see, as with COVID-19 and with any other disaster, is disproportionate death and negative impacts for those who are most vulnerable among us. These inequities are easily identifiable before disaster, and of course they're rooted in systemic bias, racism, and the country's anti-poverty mindset," end quote. Willis also said that lower-income families may not be able to stock up on essentials ahead of the storm. They may not have access to transportation in the event of an emergency, or be able to afford precautions like renters or flood insurance, leaving them vulnerable when disaster strikes. The Hill reported that, quote, "These communities are also victims of environmental racism, including redlining, which forced poor non-white people into neighborhoods that are now suffering the brunt of climate change and pollution. Research shows Black Americans are more likely than white Americans to live near landfills and industrial plants, including in Texas, where the New York Times reported that marginalized communities are at risk of exposure to pollution from industrial plants that have gone offline. Even after the disaster itself has ended, the troubles that marginalized communities face have not." The New York Times reports that, quote, "Experts worry in particular that rising energy prices amid surging demand will leave many families in the lurch, unable to pay their utility bills next month and triggering utility cutoffs at a time when they are their most vulnerable. In Texas's deregulated electricity market, prices can fluctuate with demand. That could lead to a potential jump in electric bills for poorer households that already spend a disproportionate amount of income on utilities."
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east.
Nia Gray, the faith reporter for Let's Talk About Race, believes a generation under her, a younger generation, a different generation, has pushed the issue of climate change.
I don't actually believe it's my generation that is interested in climate change, and I was quite surprised to see the statistics, but pleasantly surprised You know, when I was growing up, climate change, there still were a lot of climate change deniers. All the disinformation that was out in the late 70s and early 80s, we seem to be more consumed with like nuclear war and things like that. But it is nice to see that that the younger generations, and Althea can expand on that, are interested in climate change because they're inheriting this earth.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I think you can trace some of the generational differences there with millennials and Gen Z, who grew up either they grew up in the, you know, 2008 financial crisis, the Great Recession, or their coming of age in COVID times under a Trump presidency. This sense of urgency, this sense of crisis. There have been more public and, you know, protests around this kind of thing and localized crises that are happening more frequently, that are happening with greater severity, as we've seen with the storm in Texas. Nia was referencing the statistics that were showing people of color are generally more interested in climate change than and solving it than white people are on a statistical level. And some of that can definitely be chalked up to the politicization of the issue, right? It shouldn't necessarily be a political issue. Can crops grow? Can we survive a storm? That should be something that we should all be equally invested in. But I don't want to go totally down the road of, you know, climate change denying and that kind of thing. Where I see that difference is when you hear white leaders talk about the urgency of addressing climate change, they oftentimes are putting it in terms of, oh, our children, the future, they, you know, imagining some post-apocalyptic wasteland that looks like so many like dystopian fiction that young people have consumed. Fundamentally, that climate change, climate chaos is happening right now, and it's hitting communities of color and low-income communities first. It's not like this abstract idea of, hey, a bad thing's going to happen and maybe we should do something about it for our children. It's happening right now and it's increasing. And statistically speaking, people of color are more likely to have seen impacts of climate change in their lifetime already, or even in their parents' upbringing. One example, that being the correlation between racial redlining in neighborhoods and where high pollution infrastructure is built over the past, you know, 100 years in the United States specifically, whether that's highways or treatment plants or dumps. And those have direct negative impacts on health, well-being, and longevity for communities that have been redlined out of other areas. You also have this inequality in political power when it comes to richer, whiter folks versus communities of color that have been, you have racist voter suppression as one sort of way that that gets generated, but also how communities of color have been kept out of generational wealth building that can influence politics. All of that is to say, I see that the younger generation, those differences between higher and lower income, or what your racial identity or racial proximity to what climate change looks like in your immediate future, I think those are, it's becoming less of a divide, I think. And that's why younger folks see it as more clearly in their future.
What I love most about this planet, it's really hard. I love the way that everything just seems to have a place and everything works together to create all these wonderful things.
I was about 12 when I realised that something was going wrong. When all the mines started opening in Gunnedah and everyone only came for the money, then all the fish started turning up dead because all the mines were taking all the water and there was just nothing left.
I wish I had superpowers to blow away smoke, because we will die, animals will die, homes will die, and it's really sad.
People aren't going to get the same experiences as people in the past, which is just robbing them of everything when it's not even their fault.
When I think of saving the earth, for me it isn't necessarily about nature, but it's fundamentally about like the people who live on this planet.
My dad is from Samoa, so if we don't take action, then my family will basically not have a place to live. and they are not in a privileged enough position in the way that I am that they can afford to be climate refugees.
If we don't take action now, then we're not going to have any food or water to live. We're all going
to
die.
It would be great to have leaders that actually listen to the youth.
They get a good life and ours get worse, and then the next generation gets even worse and worse and worse until it's just a horrible life.
Not just cutting down the trees just to get money.
In 100 years or so, we're not going to have any economy if you don't focus on climate change.
The history books will rightfully so record you as doing nothing about it.
People who did make great changes in the world were the people who actually stood up and took that risk.
Every single day, children are facing the impacts of not knowing what their future is going to look like. Every single day, we get closer and closer to major tipping points. Every single day, people who live on Pacific Islander nations watch the water creep closer and closer.
At this point, we can still escape it. Like, there is hope. We're mobilising.
We're just little kids now, but when it'll be hotter, we'll be bigger. So we should, like, do it earlier so we don't get that much defence from the Earth. Like, this, our Earth can live longer, and so all of us can live longer.
If I could change one thing, I would wish that everyone would feel a sense of responsibility to others. Because I think that's what's lacking in our politicians, right down to individual members of the community. We need to start caring about other people.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race. This is our Earth Day episode.
So, Diane, you are the momentum behind the topic of this show. What did you want to address?
First, maybe some statistics to just support what Althea and Cecil said previously. People may not really embrace the fact communities of color are more significantly impacted by environmental negative or toxic environmental situations than white people. 68% of African Americans in the United States live within 30 miles of a coal plant. Coal plants are the biggest source of carbon pollution. African Americans experience asthma like 1 in 6 have asthma, where nationally 1 in 10 have asthma. Living next to a coal plant or a toxic producing industry isn't changed by salary or income with African Americans. They also found some statistics. African Americans that make $60,000 a year are still very closely living next to some sort of polluting industry. In Los Angeles, African Americans are twice as likely to die in a heat wave. They have what are called heat islands. These are areas where it's all concrete and asphalt. It's heavily populated, urban, and that is where the majority of African Americans live. So these are just some examples, you know, of the results of what happens in communities of color. And redlining, where people are able to live, has really concentrated these communities of color in areas that are adjacent to or neighboring pollution. To me, this is a human rights issue. It's civil rights and a human rights issue. What's happening because of our political structure, the EPA, which was somewhat torn apart by the Trump administration, was greatly slow to respond. And I think that you also see a real negligence in the part of the movement to take into account the social justice issues. The environmental movement, I think, in the beginning, failed to really look at what was happening in these communities. And so it's great that this is a movement that has learned and has changed and is currently focused on what is happening to these vulnerable communities.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race. This episode is called Things Fall Apart.
Baltimore is facing a number of issues. There is a dynamic through our city, often referred to as the Black Butterfly, in which the parts of East and West Baltimore are underserved across a number of metrics that also persist across the issue of trees and access to green space. We just came out of a heat wave where we had temperatures in excess of 100 degrees. What we find is in the areas that have fewer trees and have fewer green spaces, Those places are much hotter than areas with more green space, with more trees. That's only going to get worse with climate change.
Extreme heat is the leading cause of weather-related fatalities in the United States over the last several decades. People get sick when it gets really hot. Now add on top of those extreme heat waves the urban heat island effect, where our cities are amplifying temperatures to be warmer than they would be otherwise. Urban heat islands are areas of human landscapes, things like towns and cities, that based on how they've been built with dark, hard surfaces, these landscapes actually absorb more of the sun's energy during the day and then re-emit it back into the air as heat throughout the afternoon and into the evening. My very close colleague had been perfecting this methodology of measuring a city's temperature during heat waves. In 2018, we went to Baltimore, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. to conduct almost identical kinds of campaigns.
The focus of the Urban Heat Island study was to have citizen scientists gauge the temperature on the same driven route at three different times over the course of the heat wave that we were facing. I felt it as I was just driving around in my car with this thermometer sticking out my window where there were plenty of residents out waiting for buses at the bus stop, just baking in the sun, people using umbrellas. And then quickly, two blocks over, I'd be over in a highly forested area.
East Baltimore, I think, was the hottest spot in Baltimore. It was 16 or 17 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the coolest spot. Very densely canopied areas of the city tended to be the very coolest areas.
Trees are good for pretty much everything. So trees are great, one, on the obvious side of things, for improving the look and the feel of a community, even down to jobs and opportunities for folks to work. Training folks in tree care and landscaping allows us to address some of the more immediate problems that communities in East and West Baltimore are dealing with poverty. Finding ways to address immediate problems with a long-term eye is going to be really important with addressing climate change. Climate change is here today, and it's already affecting us now. And if we don't do something now, it's only going to be worse. I think the steps we take today, the trees we plant today, will mean everything to us in 20 years.
I believe climate change does have a greater impact on communities of color in three ways. Obviously, growing up in a social justice household, I was exposed to environmental racism at an early age, whether it was dumping trash in North Portland, which is a mostly African American and lower income neighborhood. But I think most Americans were exposed to environmental racism when they learned about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. And Flint, Michigan being, even though African Americans only account for less than 15% in the state, that Flint is 84% Black, and a lot of the residents there live under the poverty level. And it's interesting because a University of Michigan scientist called it the most egregious example of environmental injustice in recent U.S. history. So just like all of my esteemed colleagues have said, there's politics, there's not having a good political representation, and just also just systemic racism, that when these residents complained immediately about the contaminated water, they were dismissed and nothing really happened until it became a national story.
The images of the water are shocking enough.
Would you drink that? People have dumped in this river forever. It's like we're in a cesspool.
My tub, you should see it, it's brown.
And then come the headlines. An American city failed to provide basic protections to its citizens, and now the children of Flint have much higher than normal levels of lead in their blood. Rick Snyder, governor of Michigan, has apologized.
I am sorry, and I will fix it.
President Obama declared a national emergency.
You can't shortchange basic services that we provide to our people.
The governor of that state acted as though he didn't really care.
Lead poisoning is terrible and terrifying. No amount of exposure is safe. And there's evidence that years after we got it out of paint, gas, and more, it contributed to a drastic drop in crime in the 90s. The city has switched back to cleaner water, but the effects will last decades. We take clean water for granted. How could this possibly happen in 2016? Well, you've got to rewind to 2011. Flint was broke. It had lost about half its population after the car factories closed. It had $1.1 billion in unfunded pension costs. It had to cut half its police force. Michigan had a solution called emergency managers.
Now he's been appointed by the governor to turn around Flint's finances. Mike, welcome.
these managers can make cost-cutting measures without the normal political procedure.
I think what we have to do is look at the expense side first. There could be services that we can no longer provide in the city.
And they decided the city could save money on water. Flint would stop buying water from Detroit and join a new regional water system. And as a temporary measure, Flint would use water from the Flint River. The switch happened in 2014.
Here's the Flint.
And who decided to do this exactly is under intense debate. But regardless of blame, the story gets worse. Residents saw and tasted the dirty water and started complaining.
Water's brown, has a bad odor. I'm afraid to even feed it to my cat or my dogs.
We should not have to pay for the water. It's nasty.
But the city claimed federal tests showed the water was safe. An employee at the Environmental Protection Agency leaked a Michigan report to a local activist, which showed the water had higher than normal lead levels. The city's response? Flint told the woman the lead came from her plumbing. It took an outside investigation by Virginia Tech researchers that found elevated lead levels in the water for the state to admit there was a problem in September 2015.
So the corrosion's eating up the pipes, it's eating up the iron pipes, it's causing main breaks, it's causing discolored water. In about 20% of the homes, there's just too much lead.
In October 2015, the government bought water filters for its citizens and switched back to water from Detroit. Before all this, 2.1% of the city's children had high blood lead levels. After, it was 4%. For kids under 5 in the most affected zip codes, it was 6.3%. Why did Flint poison its citizenry? Under emergency managers from the state, it wanted to save money. To start to reverse the effects will cost dearly. Just switching back to Detroit's water cost $12 million. A class action lawsuit against the city is pending.
So I also grew up in a household of 70s music, and I recently listened to Marvin Gaye's Mercy, Mercy Me, the ecology song. And I was quite taken aback. I haven't listened to it in a long time, but it's just as timely today as it was in 1971.
Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
And just like Professor Johnson said, in 2020, Trump's EPA concluded that environmental racism is real. And there are some real, we need to do a real overhaul in the EPA. I'm not familiar with all of the different departments, but I research in EPA that it is just a revolving door of previous polluters and lobbyists that somehow are appointed to these leadership positions, and then they roll back the legislation that we need to try to, you know, sort of equalize this. The disasters disproportionately affect poor communities. My company is a company in the real estate industry, so we're putting together donations of diapers and water and sending it. But because it's such a vulnerable community anyway, existing health problems and lack of disposable income. You know, there's no funds for disaster preparation. It's expensive to try to buy extra groceries and more batteries and flashlights, and they can't fly to Cancun. I think the next thing that we'll be looking at is climate gentrification. How low-income neighborhoods who were previously undesirable are at higher land and also not as fire-prone. When we talk about the east side of LA compared to the valley. And so these neighborhoods, the residents who've lived there forever, that have a culture and a history, are being moved out. The housing prices are going up, insurance prices are going up, and it's disrupting these communities and further widening the socioeconomic gap.
Nia, I want to augment what you're talking about in regards to your generation. There was a middle school in Portland, Oregon called Whitaker Middle School. Whitaker Middle School had a predominantly youth of color population. That school had so much radon in it, they had to tear the school down.
I remember that.
And no one said anything. We had a middle school in a predominantly African-American pre-gentrified neighborhood that had to be torn down because of radon. Don't you find that interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody talked about it. And I knew friends that went to Whitaker, and all of a sudden Whitaker gets torn down. I don't remember it being in the media. But the other thing I felt is that as they went through other middle schools and elementary schools and found out that the water fountains had contaminated water. I don't know if it was contaminated when I went there, but that was actually a surprise, and that they kind of kept that information secret until it was leaked.
Portland middle schools, there's an ongoing fight in the city right now for Harriet Tubman Middle School, which is right next to the I-5. And the State Department of Transportation has sort of been hammering through a proposal to expand out in that area because it is close to the bridge that goes over into Washington. And there's horrific traffic there regularly. But they have been incredibly obstinate about listening to local leaders and local pushback about the environmental impact that it would have on this adjacent middle school. And there's also an elementary school right down the street. And so that's, you know, another place where you see young people getting, you know, seeing the reality of what that looks like, because, you know, in this particular case, not to get too deep into it, but a lot of it is motivated by trucking interests.
As you guys know, there's a highway right outside of Harriet Tubman Middle School, right where we are learning and getting our education. And this is a big problem for us because the diesel particulates and all the other emissions in the air, they can get into our lungs when we breathe them in, when we're outside, waiting for rides, things like that. And they stay in our lungs until we're really old, until we're adult, and they can cause really big diseases. So that is at least one of the big reasons why it sucks to have a school right by a highway.
You are listening to Let's Talk About Race. This is our Earth Day episode.
The state has this whole history of, you know, not being able to expand rail lines because of community pushback. And as a result, there's a lot of trucks on our roads, and trucking interests would like the traffic to go away, to expand the freeway into a middle school that is predominantly students of color in North Portland. One of the other things I wanted to point out, because Nia mentioned wildfires in California, I was also thinking about wildfires in relation to the Texas storm and thinking about severe weather events as a fact of climate change in the future. They're going to be more severe. They're going to happen more frequently. And it's not just a story of whether or not, hey, do you have, you know, a camping stove with you that you keep in the garage or something. It's not just about enduring the event itself. It's also about the fallout. And I was thinking about how the uber wealthy in California will hire private firefighters to protect their property. Their wealth will protect the things that for others, for low income people, their house might be burned to the ground. There are towns that have been entirely consumed by wildfire because they depend on state resources, because they don't have the private moneyed interest to fight the fire themselves.
And again, how it impacts us thousands of miles away in the Pacific Northwest, when that smoke blows our way, we were totally incapacitated because of the wildfire smoke. Remember that, Althea? And that was just this last past fall, Labor Day.
Yeah, another main issue with tackling climate change is that it is a global issue, right? We can, even if Portland, Oregon, or Oregon itself was going above and beyond on its climate commitments and doing everything right, if California doesn't do the same thing, we still can fall victim to that, you know, 2 weeks of smoky haze where you couldn't go outside for the pandemic, but even if you wanted to, you'd be inhaling smoke.
We had the worst air quality in the world in Portland. Remember that, Althea?
Yeah, I'd never paid so much attention to the AQI index, the air quality index, you know, not to shame China or anything, but yeah, thought we could rely on the trees.
All right, Diane Johnson, Professor Johnson, what didn't we talk about? Have we explored this issue to the best of our ability as journalists?
Yes, I think it's been a good discussion, and I'm glad that we talked about it more globally because we have to look at it that way. In the United States, the South has had the most billion-dollar disasters compared to the rest of the country combined. This is a risk for the United States. The southern regions are very vulnerable because of climate change and also because of their inability to respond. But just based on the physical location, this is going to happen more frequently. And we're looking at also the most vulnerable populations in the southern parts of the United States. These are populations where there's a high prevalence of poverty, uninsured households, income and wealth equity, issues, healthcare disparity, food insecurity. And if you look at Texas right now, it kind of looks like a third world country. And this is the richest country in the world. This should not be happening. But we are not giving this topic the urgency that it deserves.
Cecil, what didn't we talk about on this episode of Let's Talk About Race?
I think what we haven't talked about is the way in which a new generation is empowering and motivating the environmental justice movement. We see throughout not only this nation, but throughout the world, young people standing up, walking out of their schools and saying that we need to address these issues because it is an existential reality for our generations. You effed it up, and we need to live. And it isn't only a thing in which we can have intellectual conversations about. We need to decide how we are going to change our habits and redirect our economies so that we will live. That is where the energy for radical change that is needed is coming from, and we need to lift up those voices.
Nia and Althea, have we explored this topic to the best of our abilities?
This is a very layered and complicated conversation. One thing I'd like to say, what I'm surprised is that there's not a lot of folks in the Christian realm that are stepping up to have these conversations about climate change. Typically, evangelicals have, for some reason, taken the side of climate deniers, that they're very much interested in the economic prosperity of some of these towns, especially in the Rust Belt, where you find, you know, Pittsburgh with the fracking and things like that, that it's really about jobs and not about preserving the environment, which also preserves your health. So I've seen different priests in the Catholic Church and a couple other Christian organizations really try to get a handle on this disinformation. I mean, the oil companies literally said, yes, we put out disinformation. The stuff we put out was not true. It was fake information. It was fake news. And people still go back and quote those statistics. So I would encourage the Christian community to open up their Bible, do their own research, because we are stewards of this planet and we're called to protect it and each other.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race. This episode is called Things Fall Apart, Failing Infrastructure in America.
Althea?
Yeah, I think it was DuPont back in the 50s that knew the impacts that their pollution was going to have and fabricated the idea of that it was a debate if it was going to do the dangerous things that were already happening to people. Keep that in mind. But also, I wanted to mention one other thing, that there is stuff that we can do about it. It's a very, very big issue. It feels admittedly insurmountable at times, but holding your government accountable, focusing on the local, even though I mentioned that it is, you know, this major collective action problem, focusing on your local government, pushing them to make and uphold climate commitments. And as Cecil mentioned, seeking out and supporting youth environmental leaders in your community, sign a petition, support them monetarily. Those are all things that we can do to forward our climate resilience.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. Things ain't what they used to be. No. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are dying.
Okay, so for all of you, what didn't we talk about? I'd like to start with Professor Johnson and then Nia Gray, our faith reporter. And let's end it with our news director, Althea Billings. What didn't we talk about?
I would like to talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez raising $5 million for Texas. It was distributed among a lot of local organizations focusing on elder care, food assistance, homeless, and I just look at that compared to Ted Cruz, who was going on his vacation to get away from the problem. She has certainly set an example of what good leaders do, and even flew here and handed out water next to some of our other, you know, politicians here and worked directly with people. That's pretty outstanding.
So I was reading today that Virginia is set to become the first Southern state to declare racism a public health crisis.
Virginia's Black history started near the waters of Hampton Roads. And centuries later, after the first Africans came to Virginia, another milestone could be coming to the Commonwealth.
I think that in Virginia, we still have groups of people who do not believe that racism exists.
Lawmakers have pushed House Joint Resolution 537 to the desk of Governor Ralph Northam. If he signs it, racism would officially be declared a public health crisis in the state. And there would be certain policies to improve equity for all Virginians. Dr. Narkita Sparkman-Key at Old Dominion University says it is Virginia's historically racist past that has taken a medical toll on minorities.
It's the ways in which racism impede on all these other different factors.
ODU's Marvin Childs, with a PhD in African-American history, says racist policies cast influence across the state.
Cities like Richmond, Norfolk, when they became bigger entities or modern entities in the early 20th century, blacks were segregated out of the nicer sides of town.
The measure, sponsored by Central Virginia Delegate LaCherise Aird, lists five steps to address systemic racism in the state. Just one example, the permanent creation of a commission to look at racial inequity in Virginia law. Both Sparkman-Key and Childs agreeing it's a good first step, with more work still to be done.
And why that matters is if this ordinance gets voted in, that it could possibly free up money to do equity research, to make monies available to support different organizations, and really kind of put a list of definitions and terms together on racism in with a lens in health and equality and community engagement. So only time will tell if this is a symbolic vote or really will be the catalyst for change and spread throughout the South.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east.
Indigenous peoples have been on the front lines of environmental racism for decades. And I think that what has people finally starting to recognize what's going on with Indigenous rights is that the things that Indigenous peoples have been facing for decades are now leaking out into the commons, and other people are starting to become affected. I think the thing that really got me moving in regard to environmental justice was growing up on an island nation where we were prohibited from being able to actually go into the water that surrounded us. When I was a child, going into the river was one of the things that I would get in the most trouble for with my family, because it was so contaminated that people that would go into the water would get sores on their bodies. And so there was this deep grief in the community about not being able to interact with the waterways that surrounded us in ways that have historically defined our culture.
The leadership of Indigenous groups, especially in the United States, in repairing mankind's relationship to the earth, especially in the United States, Indigenous peoples are some of the prime recipients of environmental racism, if you will, with the reservation system, among many other injustices, and following their understanding of the land and how humanity can coexist with our environment, I think is important to highlight.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
That was an edition of Let's Talk About Race, produced at Pacifica Radio affiliate station KBOO in Portland, Oregon. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.